That's what she said.
That's what she said.
That's what she said.
That's what she said.
Well, that's what she said.
Hey, welcome to the latest edition of That's What She Said with Sarah Spain. Excited for you to hear this episode. I found it absolutely fascinating to talk to my guest, Kevin Brilliant, who is a business strategy and analytics manager at the Chicago Bulls, which was a job I did not even know existed until I met him. I had the pleasure of attending the Global Sports Management Summit in Chicago a week or so ago, and I had never heard of it before. They reached out to me to moderate a panel with Crane Kenny on navigating a championship season for the Cubs and a sort of honoring and mini roast of Mike Ditka as a sort of lifetime achievement award. I also was moderating a panel on social issues and sports, one of the members of which was Harry Edwards, which was really interesting to hear him speak and to talk to him about some of the trends in both athletes and media in terms of the connection between social issues and sports and activism. But I picked up so many fascinating insights. There was a great conversation between the 49ers VP of communications and the former president of the Clippers talking about managing the media and PR in times of crisis or challenge. And that, of course, really interesting in light of the Donald Sterling and Colin Kaepernick issues that both teams went through and that those particular men had to handle. So I was just fascinated by getting to talk to a bunch of GMs and CEOs, CMOs of various teams and leagues, and what is on top of mind for them and for their leagues, both public-facing and internally. It was a really cool experience. And I heard Kevin Brilliant, today's guest, speak, and I just loved the topic. I'm really fascinated by human psychology and behavior, why we do the things we do, how the way we think about the things we do affects us. And he just had some really interesting insights on how using behavioral economics and psychology to understand how things make people feel or why people make the choices they do can actually influence practices as a team, whether that's how your lines are set up, how you try to manage your sponsorship deals and reaching out to fans on behalf of those sponsors, or how you sell your merchandise. So I think you guys will be really interested in the things that he has to say, probably learning the ways that you are being marketed to or appealed to without even understanding it, non-conscious ways that teams or leagues are appealing to things that you have somehow let them know you're interested in, whether that be via information that you've submitted or actions you've taken or behaviors that you've shown over time. Another woman also spoke named Cy Wakeman, and she talked about leadership and managing office spaces and companies and teams and a group of people in the best possible way and managing without ego and drama. I'm really hoping to get her on the podcast as well, but a little snippet of something she talked about actually led to a conversation that Kevin and I had after the pod was done recording about the ways that some people don't analyze their own practices in terms of how it makes them feel or how they approach their daily life. And so I was talking to him about how he'd missed Sai's speaking and how she was so engaging and interesting, and how she talked about how if we filter everything around us through our ego, it can change the way we perceive things. People who tend to think that everyone's out to get them will change a simple phone call from their boss asking how a project is doing to micromanaging or a sign that they're going to get fired or whatever. And then they spin it forward to all the possible scenarios of all the bad things that would happen if they got fired, instead of just acknowledging that it was a single phone call and not letting their ego get in the way of responding to the actual question, which was just, how's this project going? And a lot of people think of ego as just the idea of being full of yourself, but it's also sort of a protective layer in which to view the world around you and how people are interacting with you and how you're interacting with them. And so much of what Sai said really resonated with me in terms of the things that you choose to internalize and be frustrated by and the things that you let go of. And I have had a fair amount of colleagues who don't understand the power of picking your battles, who either feel like everyone's always out to get them because their pitches for their stories aren't well received, or somebody in the office, they don't think that they're listening to their insight. And yeah, absolutely. Sometimes there are people out to get you, or sometimes there are toxic work environments. There's also opportunities for you to let things slide and not get caught up in them and put your best foot forward and not let your ego get in the way of getting the job done. When we have Sion, which I'm crossing my fingers, you'll understand this a lot more. But it reverted me in my conversation with Kevin back to something I harp on a lot on the pod. And so if you listen regularly, you'll recognize this is something I always come back to. But I've been reminded of it even more recently, and I wanted to remind you guys of it as well. The idea of feeling gratitude every day, of expressing gratitude every day. And there's a story that I read, and I've talked about it before, about the power of waking up in the morning and deciding you'll send an email to someone who's done something nice for you, or who has helped you, or whose work helps you do your job. And maybe there isn't someone every day that you can think of. Maybe that's asking too much. But the idea that so many of us forget to have those feelings of gratitude, and it never allows us to be satisfied and centered in the things that we have. And it always, the people who can't be grateful and satisfied are always looking for what's next. And I think that's a really sad and difficult way to go through life. And when I was talking to Kevin about that, he recommended a book called Triggers by Marshall Goldsmith. And so I'm going to recommend it to anyone listening who maybe wonders how their thoughts, positive or negative, might be affecting the way that their life is going. And this is a little blurb about the book. Triggers confronts head-on the challenges of behavior and change, looking at the external factors or triggers, both negative and positive, that affect our behaviors, our awareness of when we need to change, our willingness or otherwise to do so, and our ability to see the change through. Drawing on his unparalleled experience as an international executive educator and coach, Marshall Goldsmith invites us to understand how our own beliefs and the environments in which we operate can trigger negative behaviors or a resistance to the need to change. But he also offers up some simple practical advice to help us navigate the negative and make the most of the triggers that will help us to sustain positive change. If it sounds like something you're interested in, again, it's called Triggers by Marshall Goldsmith. I know I already ordered it. I'm fascinated by the idea of how we create our own moods and how much it really does matter if you're prescient and aware of your attitude toward life, the people around you, your job, and everything else. So, as Julie Foudy likes to say, have an attitude of gratitude and listen to my awesome conversation with Kevin Brilliant. That's next.
That's what she said.
Hey, more That's What She Said coming in just a minute. But first, I want to hear from you. Whether you're new to the pod or you've been listening for a while, I want to hear from you. I want to know how we're doing. I want to know what you want to hear from me, what guests you want, and I want to get your feedback. So if you're listening in Apple Podcasts, please leave a rating and a review. And if you like what you hear, make sure you're subscribed so every time there's a new episode, it'll come right to you. If you subscribe in the ESPN app, we can send you an alert when we've got a new episode, and you can always tweet your thoughts at Sarah Spain. But I've been told lately that rating and reviewing is super important. So if you like my pod and you like the product, go give it a rating and a review and say nice things about me.
That's what she said.
Happy now to welcome Kevin Brilliant. And yes, that is his real last name. It's even better than mine. Spain is fun, but Brilliant sets you up for success. He's the business strategy and analytics. What's the actual title?
Business strategy and analytics manager.
Manager. Manager for the Chicago Bulls. Also the co-founder of the Duke Behavioral Science and Sports Roundtable. As I mentioned in the intro, heard him speak at the Global Sports Management Summit and was fascinated to learn about the crossover between human behavior and psychology in regards to sport team, and just wanted to pick his brain even further. But before we get to some of the stuff you covered at the summit, I want to start with how you grew up in Lake Forest. Mm-hmm. You're a Chicago sports fan. When you got to Duke, was this your undergrad or your master's?
Master's. MBA.
MBA. Did you already know what part of psychology and human behavior you wanted to focus on?
No, I had no idea. So I went back to get my MBA with the purpose of making a transition into sports afterwards. So I knew that was ultimately my destination. On day two of orientation, a guy by the name of Gavin Fitzsimmons, who teaches consumer behavior there, got up in front of our MBA class and started talking about the way the mind forms cognitive associations. Basically, he was telling our class, don't be the guy that throws up on your classmates this weekend because people remember that stuff.
Right.
But I remember just being captivated by the way that he talked about the brain and neuroscience. And I sort of, in an instant, knew that that's exactly what I wanted to study in sports.
Interesting.
So over the next 2 years, I really threw myself headfirst into consumer behavior and behavioral economics. Year two, I was fortunate enough to join the lab of Dan Ariely, who wrote Predictably Irrational. He's one of the leading behavioral scientists in the world. And at the time, I knew I had the Bulls job waiting for me after graduation. And so I used the time I had in his lab to study applications of behavioral economics in sports. And so for people who don't know what behavioral economics is, it's basically the study of the non-conscious biases and hidden forces that shape our decision-making and judgment. So at any point in time, sort of 95% of human cognition happens at a non-conscious level, right? There are only so many things we're thinking about consciously, but there are all these forces that influence
right.
how we think and act and how we experience things like sports that aren't immediately apparent to us. And so behavioral economics seeks to understand why people make the choices they make, and in the context of sports, how teams can use that to create a better fan experience.
So does behavioral economics only address non-conscious? So it doesn't address, say, I'm going to use Lyft instead of Uber because Lyft donated to the ACLU and Uber, the guy was in a meeting with Trump. Or I'm going to choose this food product because I saw someone eating it on TV and I don't even know that's why I'm choosing it. Is that the difference there in what you're analyzing?
Well, so, I mean, building associations at a conscious level is something that marketers have been doing for as long as
right.
marketing existed, right? Like the associations that you think of when you see a logo or you're exposed to a brand, I mean, that's the purpose of having a logo, is to conjure up all the different things that are associated with that brand. So that can be very intentional. And I think that's sort of your classic marketing. I think
right.
behavioral economics is more focused on understanding things that people aren't immediately aware of. What's interesting, though, is some of these biases are so strong. They're called heuristics or rules of thumb, ways that we process an incredible amount of information in the environment and distill it down into something we can manage on a moment-to-moment basis. Some of these things are so strong that even if you tell someone the effect that's happening, they still can't get away from the fact that they have a bias.
Right.
And so Daryl Morey shares a pretty interesting story about during the lockout, he took a class at Harvard. And the experiment was...
This is the Rockets GM.
That's exactly right. The experiment was write down the last two numbers of your phone or social security number. And sort of the principle is anchoring.
Mm-hmm.
When you see something, that becomes immediately your reference point. And whatever you estimate afterwards or whatever you project is based on what you just saw. And so the question is, how many countries are there in Africa?
Mm-hmm.
And it's almost perfectly correlated, the guess that people make, with what they wrote down on their paper.
Really?
Yeah, and the funny thing about that is even if you tell them exactly what I just told you, they will still be biased in the guess that they make because it's so strong. Like, they don't know in a vacuum what to guess.
Right.
But once they write down a number, that becomes their reference point.
You wait until you ask someone who's like a geography professor, and then they completely blow the study for you because their number is nothing like the actual number of countries in Africa.
Yeah.
You mentioned that you already had the job set up at the Bulls. Was this the first iteration of this particular job for the team?
Yeah, so the group was founded a couple years before I joined, and then my boss came on.
So there's a larger group at the Bulls.
Yeah, business strategy and analytics is
okay.
the larger group. They were looking for someone to fill that role independent of behavioral economics, and it just so happened that I had a background in it. And our team president, Michael Reinsdorf, his favorite author, happens to be my mentor from grad school. So
Got
I
it.
Sort of landed in the perfect spot.
How did you find out about the job while you were still at school?
A guy who is a year above me is in the same role for the Milwaukee Bucks, and saw the opening come across his desk and forwarded it to me.
Anyone listening, so my podcast, I talk a lot about process, how people get to where they are, and I know a lot of people listening are aspirational and want to figure out how to work in sports, so you're going to be the one that breaks them because they're going to be like, you already had a job before you left school? Because I'm always preaching, like, you're going to do a bunch of weird before you get to where you're supposed to
yep.
be, and that's okay. Don't give up. And instead, they're going to look at you and be like, oh, that should have been me. I'm a special unicorn. I should already be doing what I want to do.
Well, the piece of advice I always give people who are looking for jobs in sports is that sports is just a business on the business side, right? Like, it's great that you want to work in a passion area and the content you know is what you want to work on, but, like, what do you actually want to do in the industry?
Right.
In the industry? So my passion happened to be psychology, behavioral economics, and the study of how to create better experiences for fans. That's something you could do in any business. I'm just fortunate to do in the area I'm most
right.
passionate about.
Well, and you could do it in another business, acquire a bunch of skills and credibility,
mm-hmm.
and then force yourself into the passion area that you want once you've established yourself. If you can't find that first job in the sports realm, do it elsewhere and then
Well,
carry
so
it
I started
over.
My career as a strategy consultant at McKinsey because I knew I wanted to build up skills related to running a business, working with senior executives, and then eventually transition that into sports.
Hmm. So you are a hometown kid. The Bulls job seems like this perfect
yep.
spot, particularly because of Reinsdorf's connection to your mentor. So you presume that you're going to have sort of the same approach to the topic. When you get to the Bulls, how long have you been in this job now?
It'll be 2 years next week.
When you get to the Bulls and you have your first couple meetings, what do they tell you that they want from you in the position?
So the mandate for our group is really to use information about our fans to try to create the experience that they're looking for. I think sports has been run for a very long period of time as a small family-owned business, right? Like, despite what you think of the global reputation of the Chicago Bulls and everything you know about the Jordan effect, really teams are starting to evolve on a business sense, I would say, behind other industries. And so the mandate for our group is to infuse the organization with data-driven decision-making, a process for trying to develop programs that meet fans' needs, things of that nature.
Got it. So do you know that if most of the teams now have similar departments?
So
in the NBA, at least?
Yeah, most of the teams in the NBA have an analytics group. In fact, every team does, to varying degrees. So you have teams that are all in on it. You have teams that are working more in, like, their ticketing department to try to use analytics to set prices, things of that nature. So I would say everybody's aware of the importance of having a group like this on the business side, and I would say it followed Moneyball by about 5 years.
Right.
Basically, Moneyball launched this.
Well, and analytics was on the court.
Yep.
For Moneyball or on the field.
Right.
And it carried over into the front office in terms of not just how you choose your players, but how you serve your fans.
That's exactly right. So basically, people saw it working on the basketball side or the baseball side and said, well, we should probably do that internally as well. And so teams have been building up that capability. It does vary within the industry how much emphasis teams are placing on it on the business side.
I at that Global Sports Management Summit, I did a conversation with Crane Kenny about the Cubs win, and one of the things that we talked about was how useful it's been and effective for their company and their franchise to have very set roles of who runs what, and everybody trusts each other in that capacity. That Ricketts isn't trying to make personnel decisions. He trusts Theo, and Theo trusts Crane with the business side. When you are in your department, is there any crossover? Are there any people at the Bulls who are concerned with the players and the strategy and what happens on the court as well as what happens elsewhere? Or is it pretty evenly divided in separate
no,
positions?
There's a separation of church and state, so to speak.
Yeah.
So we have people on the marketing and branding side that work really closely with our players to put them in photo shoots and all the things that they do to interact. Our community relations teams is incredible, the way they get players involved in incredible causes. But there's no crossover in terms of people who work in business and work in basketball.
Do you, in your department, need to be able to understand the non-conscious effect of certain players or the non-conscious brand appeal? Like, do you need to be able to look at the specific makeup of the team, or is your work more centered on the general principles of how humans interact with sports, how humans interact with traffic and ticketing and concessions and stuff like that?
Yeah, I think the crossover there is in terms of marketing and branding. Teams that have a culture and players that fit a culture that matches the city have an amplification effect in the terms of people connecting with it. So if you think of, like, the Showtime Lakers, for example, that perfectly replicated the culture of L.A. If you think of the blue-collar nature of the Chicago Bulls, Jimmy Butler, right?
Right.
Stacey King says all the time, right, lunch pail and hard hat.
Yeah, or the bench mob vibe that they had for a while. A lot of those players that weren't stars on their own but would come in and put in the hard work, that became a really big thing for fans.
Yeah, and that resonated with people in Chicago because it matched the culture. So in terms of understanding the dynamics of the players we have on the basketball side, I think that's where it becomes important because people connect with what is familiar and what they know. And when players have that mentality and mindset, it endears them to the city of Chicago.
So what are some of the ways you've already helped the Bulls change their practices by virtue of some of your psychology studies and knowledge?
Yeah, so one of the most interesting examples was the first large-scale field experiment that we ran. We have a partner who is a timeshare company, and people don't have great sort of views of timeshare companies to begin with.
Mm-hmm. A lot of people imagine it's we're going to spend a lot of time in meetings, you're going to badger us, it's going to be a hard, hard sell. And we're not going to enjoy the time that we spend there because we're going to be being sold to the whole time.
That's exactly right.
Right.
And so we actually have maybe the one timeshare company that isn't like that. And the deal they're offering our season ticket holders is actually incredible. I've taken them up on it. It is spectacular. The problem, though, is that the deal they're offering to people sounds too good to be true. And so we all have this bias when we're presented with information that seems too good to be true. We reject it as something that seems implausible. And so we were experiencing
it happens
that
with men, and it happens with business offers, right? Something's going to be wrong with this one.
That's exactly right. And so we all have that hidden bias.
Yeah.
And so the problem here was that it actually was an incredible offer that we wanted people to take up. But they weren't converting or going down or expressing interest.
And it was an incredible offer because the company needed them to go. And so they were okay with the value monetarily of it not being met, because the point is to get those people into the place and have them like it and see it and then want to be a part of it.
That's exactly right. Like, it's as straightforward as it gets.
It feels too good to be true because the company is willing to lose money in order to get eyeballs.
Knowing that just getting people down there to experience the resort would eventually convert into business, and that's good for everybody. A couple things came up at a meeting that we had with them that led me down this path of experimenting, which was, number one, at one point in time, they changed the offer. So the offer was $199 for a couple. You pay for airfare and food while you're down there. But otherwise, you can stay at a four-diamond resort in Nueva Vallarta, Mexico, for four nights for free. Again, it challenges people to believe that that is actually a legitimate offer. At one point in time, the company changed the offer from $199 per couple to $299 per person, and conversion went up. Now, if the laws of rational economic theory applied, that should never be the case, right? The demand curve slopes down. But all of a sudden, people looked at the offer and said, okay, instead of being implausibly good, it's just a really good offer, and therefore I'd like to take advantage of it. The other thing that they shared in this meeting was they partnered with a golf course management company to give this exact same offer to people who got hole-in-ones. And of that group, they converted like four times the rate that our season ticket holders were converting. The reason is that people no longer had a reason to be skeptical, right? My ball went in the hole. Either it was luck or skill, whatever.
I've earned it.
Exactly. Like, I have a reason to understand why I'm getting such a good offer. Therefore, I don't have to question it. So in terms of setting up this inquiry into sort of behavioral science and psychology, we did two versions. One was, this is a gift to you as a valued season ticket holder, which on the surface you would think would be a really nice thing, but it doesn't quite satisfy the curiosity about why the offer is so good. In the other condition, the test version, we said, we need your input on behalf of our partner. They're looking for feedback on their guest experience. If you're willing to provide input when you get back, here is this offer for you. And the genesis of that was based on the conversation I just mentioned, but also I talked to Dan immediately when that happened. He said, listen, it doesn't take a lot to make people feel like they're putting in enough effort to justify what they're getting. So just ask them to do a little more. And we did that, and the conversion rate of calls and phone click-throughs and people going down there was like six times greater than what you need to write an academic paper.
Which is crazy, because if you said to people and you explained it to them the way you just did, they would say, cool, I'll go ahead and take the $199 for a couple, I won't fill out a survey, and I'll enjoy it.
That's exactly
right. But they don't have all that information, then they don't know why their brain is doing what it is, so instead they end up putting in more work and paying more for a deal they could have had for less if they'd understood the psychology behind it.
Well, and that's the thing, is that in any sort of given moment, an economist would tell you that we're capable of processing every piece of information in the known universe and making the perfectly rational decision. But in reality, that's not the case. We have so many things that we're working on or mentally processing at any given moment in time that we have to develop these heuristics or shortcuts that allow us to distill down information. So one of them is the price-quality heuristic.
Right.
People have a really fixed association between something costing more and being more valuable, which is sort of the effect that's in play here with raising the price. If you want to confuse people, one of the ways to do so is to take two products that are equivalent or substitutes, one of which is clearly superior than the other one, and make it cost less money. They'll freak out. Not only will they not buy more of that product, even though it's a good deal, they will abandon the process in a lot of cases because they will become so frustrated trying to figure out what's going on that they'll want no part of it.
Yeah, that's fascinating, because I think that there are obviously things that we're okay with paying less for and not assuming a precipitous drop in quality, right? If you go to a Mexican restaurant and you can get some cheap tacos and they're delicious, you're okay with that, but you're probably not going to do the same for a seafood dinner.
Yeah.
Same with like furniture. There are some pieces of furniture that you figure I'm okay spending less on this, but maybe not the couch because it's going to break or it's going to rip or it's not going to stand the test of time. I find myself doing that all the time where I look at something and I'm like, like the great example I remember when I first moved to L.A., for Mother's Day, I was just noticing all the parts of L.A. that were incredibly superficial and totally different from the Midwest. And the Mother's Day edition of the L.A. Times had all these special coupons in the back for like Botox and plastic surgery and stuff. And I was like, things I'm not going to skimp on, plastic surgery. Like, yeah. No one wants to go get a cheapo nose job because the quality you believe to be, there's no way that this could end up being just a good deal.
Well, that's interesting that you bring that up because there are examples of OBGYNs, for instance, who want to sort of semi-retire, and they doubled the rate of what they're charging, and all of a sudden, demand for their services went through the roof.
Yeah.
Because people associate that with something, I am willing to pay for this.
Right.
And the fact that you are charging more must imply that
you're
a
better doctor.
Therefore, I value your services above and beyond what it would have been had you charged less.
Yeah, that's crazy.
Yeah.
Of course, that doesn't always work, because sometimes I'll say, oh, I don't need a $500 haircut.
Right. And so there are two types of goods and services when you evaluate. There's utilitarian goods, which are sort of, what's the utility I get out of it? What's the toothbrush, the toothpaste? It's sort of transactional in nature. When you're evaluating those types of goods and services, your mind naturally gravitates to its analytical part. So you actually do the cost-benefit trade-off of the good and service.
Right.
When you're buying something that's called a hedonic good or a pleasurable good, you just, in the abstract, think, is this something that would make me happy? Mm. Which, interestingly, is why when you're marketing a utilitarian good, you can use non-rounded prices. But when you want someone to make a hedonic decision, you use rounded prices because you don't want them trying to think about the cost-benefit trade-off.
Right.
You just want them thinking, is this worth it to me?
So a toothbrush could be $4.99, mm-hmm. and you're thinking, what a good deal. A massage would be $50.
Exactly.
Because you don't want them thinking about the price. You want them just thinking about the service.
Right. You just want
Which is
them
funny because they actually, that's 100% true. You don't see spa services and stuff like that using those prices.
Because the moment that you make it more analytical, people start processing that with a different part.
Right.
Of
and
their
do
brain.
I have the money to spend on this, mm-hmm. and should I do it versus I'm making this choice because my body just said it wants a massage or a spa treatment or a haircut. Whatever.
Right. And with
That's
massages
fascinating.
Or sports.
And it's completely true.
Yeah, exactly. With massages or sports, those are entertainment-based activities. They're pleasure-based activities. So when people want to consume your product, they want to do so without having to think about all that other stuff in the way that they would if they were shopping at Walmart for clothes or items.
Right. And there's likely a guilt associated with something that is not useful to you. It's simply a pleasure.
Mm-hmm.
And then if you stay out of the analytical part of it, then you're less likely to talk yourself out of whether you deserve to spend the money on it.
Yeah.
That's interesting. Anything else you've done, like specifically with the Bulls, that's a good example of taking this and applying it to a team?
Yeah. So one of my favorite experiments that had been conducted by a different league was about the difference between serpentine lines and pick a line format. And this is something we talked about at the Global Sports Management
Center.
Yeah, this
is really interesting.
What they wanted to test was which line was favorable if you had a choice between the two. And the intuition behind it actually makes a lot of sense, right? Waiting in line as a sports fan when the game is happening is probably the least pleasurable part of the experience.
So stressful, especially when Devin Hester was on the Bears.
Yeah.
Because if you didn't get there on time, you legit might have missed the only touchdown the Bears would score
Devin
on the
Hester,
opening
you
kickoff.
Are ridiculous.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
And I remember missing multiple.
I remember watching
huge
the opening
returns.
Play of the Super Bowl and I
Oh, I was there for that. I made it in
you
time.
Were there for that?
I made it in time.
That's awesome.
I almost blew a vein in my head. I was so excited.
Yeah, it was incredible. And then they didn't kick them in the game.
Yeah.
But basically, they wanted to solve for the fact that this is an incredibly unpleasant part of the experience. So can we improve it, right? Great intuition. So on the basis of analytics, they concluded that pick-a-line formats, and so pick-a-line is like, think toll booths or supermarkets, right? You have a choice of which line you get in. Serpentine lines are TSA, so the first person in line goes to whatever register is open next.
Right. You're all in one long line,
yep.
and at the end you go to the one that next opens if you're the next.
Exactly. And so on the basis of analytics, they concluded that pick-a-line formats are faster, which they are, and it makes sense. In pick-a-line formats, you're waiting immediately behind the person that you're about to follow up. In a serpentine line format, you have to walk over there, and so it's about 15% faster to do pick-a-line. And so on the basis of analytics, they recommended to all of their clubs that whenever possible, they should choose pick-a-line formats because it's better for the fan experience.
Because it's faster.
It's because it's faster, right? It makes sense on the surface, right? But if everything that seemed correct also turned out to be true, there would be no meaning to the term counterintuitive. And clearly, we know that has meaning.
Mm-hmm.
So, fortunately, Mythbusters also conducted this experiment.
Mm.
And they found, like this league, that pick-a-line format is indeed faster by about 15%. But what they also found was that people overwhelmingly prefer serpentine lines. So how can that be the case? And so it comes down to a couple things. Number one, there's two ways to judge fairness. One is outcome fairness, and we typically determine if the outcome fairness, whether it helped us or not. The other is procedural.
Right. Fairness. It's not actually how fair it was. It was, did it turn out in my favor? And then if it did, I think it was fair.
Yeah, we can talk ourselves into anything. The other way is procedural fairness. And there's nothing more procedurally fair than the first person who got in line goes next. Mm-hmm. The second part is something called regret and counterfactuals. And so regret is one of the most powerful forces in behavioral science because we tend to imagine how things could have played out differently, and we feel losses far more significantly than we experience equivalent gains. In the case of picking a line, over time, every good choice you make is balanced out by picking the wrong line. But in our minds, we overemphasize the times that we were wrong, that we made the wrong choice, that it didn't work out in our favor, and it becomes incredibly
frustrating. How many of us literally say every time, I always get in the wrong line?
That's exactly
even
right.
Even if you don't, even if there's plenty of times when you haven't, you think about it when it happens, and that's what sticks with you.
Because what happens, as soon as you get in line,
someone has a checkbook, and you're like, really, in 2017, a check?
Well, that's exactly right. So I was at Target the other day, and I was not really paying attention. I was in line. I picked the line, of course. And I was sort of looked up after 5 minutes, and I saw this woman paying a $30 bill entirely in change. And I think she was trying to teach her kid fiscal responsibility because the kid had the toy.
Save it.
It might have been his piggy bank. Which is noble, but not at 6 p.m. on a Tuesday.
Yeah, maybe teach them in the parking lot and then transfer into dollars and spend the dollars.
That's
in the
exactly
store.
Right. But by the time she got to $12, she had long since run out of quarters. So now she was counting in insultingly low denominations. Oh. And actually, when she got to $24, the guy in line pulled his wallet out, grabbed $6,
I would absolutely do that.
All right, let's move on.
Yeah.
So, but I mean, we all know what that feels like, right? Like you picked the wrong line. And a counterfactual is the mind's ability to imagine how a scenario might have played out differently. So think, what if Seattle had run the ball on third and goal instead of passed, right?
Right.
When bad things happen, we're especially prone to imagining alternative scenarios. Mm-hmm. And there's a huge mental and emotional cost to thinking about how things might have played out differently. And people will go to extraordinary lengths to avoid that possibility of being wrong, even if they know it requires a greater investment of time in a different type of scenario.
So did you then employ serpentine lines everywhere?
Good question. It's something that we're looking at.
Okay. Because I would say the recent games I've been to, they have not been that.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's a great question. So last year we installed new security measures entering the stadium. And actually, that's an interesting concept all into itself. Disney figured this out a long time ago. It's a concept called bending time. And it is, even if you have to wait in line for a certain amount of time, how do you make it more pleasurable?
Right.
So research shows that if you give the mind something to be distracted with or something to be entertained by, and so Disney will put up
things to read along the way stuff, videos to watch.
So, I mean, security lines at sporting events are unavoidable and they're necessary and they're important. But what can you do from a behavioral science standpoint to make it a better experience for people, even if you can't change the amount of time they wait in line?
Yeah. So it's funny, you mentioned how the brain will come up with ways of recasting what would have happened if something goes wrong. I don't know if you've seen the movie 500 Days of Summer, but there's this great scene where his ex-girlfriend invites him to a party, and they actually split the screen for the next however, like 5 minutes. And on the left is what actually happens, and on the right is what he thought would happen. When they show these disparate realities, and it's far more crushing to witness his expectation alongside the cruel reality of her having met someone new than it would be to know what he was thinking and then just display the reality of it. And you know what I mean? It affected you in a much stronger way to recast the whole thing and say, this is what would have happened if things had gone my way. So it's interesting how we do that, especially when we make the wrong choice.
Yeah.
Because you said regret is so powerful.
Absolutely. And you think about world-class athletes have the ability to move on.
Right.
Right. They will clinically study the way that they made a mistake in a big situation so they can learn for the next time, but they will not indulge the mind's need to imagine how it could have played out differently because it will prevent them from moving
doing it in the forward. We always talk about that short memories or, you know, like James Harden going clubbing after he has probably the worst game of a superstar in an NBA playoff scenario that was a huge game that we've seen in maybe forever. It looked like he forgot how to play basketball. And he goes to the club after, and we're like, how does he do that? He doesn't care. And we're like, no, it's not that he doesn't care. It's like, that's how you have to be at that point of that job.
That's exactly right. Yeah. You have to move on. You can't allow yourself to stay stuck in past mistakes because they have to perform in the future, and the ability to forget that is an important part of what makes them superstars.
So I was thinking about your Global Sports Summit. Actually, I wasn't. I thought about it after the fact. I had just gotten back from Paris when I went. And I was at Versailles. And the line was over 2 hours. Mm-hmm. And it was serpentine, so that you could not believe that you chose the wrong one. You just went literally in a long snake in front of the palace, and you eventually got in. And about 40 minutes in, I thought to myself, how am I going to stop staring at people and looking for cutters? Because I legitimately think if I ever physically harm another human being, it will be because they cut in line or because they didn't let me get off the train first before they tried to get on. I've literally elbowed like 14-year-old kids to teach them a lesson. It's a problem I have. That's the thing that makes me the most angry in the world, is the unfairness of mm-hmm. people not following the rules of things like lines. I don't know why it bothers me so much. It makes me insane. So I'm watching the line so carefully to make sure people aren't sneaking in that I'm causing myself massive amounts of stress, and I'm supposed to just be enjoying. And I'm like, you know what? It's a nice day out. If I was just sitting enjoying the day, I'd be okay with it. But because of this, it's freaking me out. So I put a podcast in, and I put one headphone in my husband's ear and one in mine, and tried to pass the time mm-hmm. listening to some podcasts, which, like you said, is that bending time. Mm-hmm. It went much faster after I occupied our minds with something and tried to look down at the ground so I wouldn't focus on all the cutters. Of course, then we got to the end, and multiple people cut, and I started screaming at them in a combination of French and English because yep. I'm a nut job and I can't prevent myself due to fairness. And I was like, you're raising your kids wrong. You're setting a bad example. Vous êtes une personne très mal. And I'm just freaking out because nothing stresses me out more than that. So in your research, have you not only found best practices as far as what people think feels better, but any way for people to deal with the immense amount of stress that is caused by that worry about fairness?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I was having this conversation with a guy by the name of Rory Sutherland, who runs Ogilvy & Mather's UK Behavioral Insights team. And he was talking about the premise of why we get stressed out when we're getting to the front of the line. And it's actually because of the people behind us. We're mentally picturing the fact that we are inconveniencing them in some way or another, and that we're being expected to move at a certain rate. Like, think about people who are ordering off of a menu at a fast food place. You probably know exactly what you're going to get. You've been waiting there for 10 minutes, but why do people get flustered when they get to the front of the line? It's because there's this expectation that they will be able to perform the task of ordering in front of other people and get out of their way. That imagined stress is something that you can move, remove. So that's why Disney, they have sort of jagged line formats where you can only see a few people in front of you.
Yeah.
The reason is because you don't want to feel like people are waiting behind you and expecting you to move through the line fast.
And that was the problem with Versailles, and that mm-hmm. why it's the most stressful line I've ever been in my entire life, is they don't have any way to block it. So you can see how far you have to go, and you can see how far behind you it's growing.
Yep.
And you can see how there's no gates in between people, how easy it would be to just cut in.
Yeah.
And it stressed me out for 2 full hours.
Well, I mean, it makes sense that Disney would be one of the leading experts in this, because the entire experience is 95% waiting in line and 5% being on the rides. So they've been studying the science of how to make that more pleasurable for years. And one of the things they concluded is, if you can visually remove the stress of seeing what's in front of you and behind you, just like your experience, ultimately people will be more satisfied with what they're doing.
So this is not related to sports, but you just made me think of it, and you might have an answer that will help me. I have a problem of empathy in terms of situations like the one you described, where you're worried about people behind you, so you rush. I do it at like a restaurant. Having worked in a restaurant, I'll order more than I want because I feel bad if I have a table and I'm taking up space, that the waitress or the waiter will be sad that they got a bad table that mm-hmm. didn't spend as much. Because I remember all my friends would come, my table's just sitting there, they didn't order anything. So now I process that in my head, and I buy stuff I don't want just because I feel bad. Or I'll wait forever, just like everyone else does. And when I get, I'll like not do the things that I want. I won't take as much time as I want because I'll feel guilty, even though I've put in as much time and I'm not owing anyone anything. Mm-hmm. How do you stop that? How do you like prevent yourself from over analyzing or over fearing for like how you're inconveniencing others?
That's a great question. On the topic of why you overorder when you're sitting at a table, there's an entire part of behavioral science built around the science of reciprocity. And so Adam Grant writes Give and Take. It's an incredible exploration of how people use relationships in order to benefit each other. Robert Cialdini wrote the book Influence, where he went undercover and studied like 30 different sales jobs to figure out what actually moved the needle. Hmm. Part of the research in both those cases was that reciprocity, or when someone gives something to us, we feel compelled to give something back to them, is a huge motivator in what shapes our behavior. So one of the most famous experiments is about what compels people to give tips in restaurants. And so the little piece of candy that the waiter or waitress mm-hmm. leaves for you when they give you your bill is a form of a gift. And what they've done is experimented with what happens if, as the person's walking away, they come back and say, actually, here's a second piece of candy. Tips go up by like 20%.
Huh.
They've even found, interestingly enough, that if they put the bill on a plate that's shaped like a heart, people will give greater tips because it sort of activates an association with generosity.
Right.
So the science of reciprocity, I guess, is do nice things for other people and it'll come back to you.
Right. Doesn't really help me, but I'm aware of my neuroses. I'm and I think it's usually functional and helpful to be a good person because you actually care about other people's time and everything else. But it can be stressful too. I can't stand being late. It gives me like actual ulcers because I feel like I'm inconveniencing other people.
Well, and that's sort of the whole backdrop of behavioral science, right? Like some people, if they wanted to, could use it for the wrong reasons.
Right.
But
right,
the people
right.
who I have had the privilege of studying under and work with. You use behavioral science and an understanding of psychology to create better experiences for people. And ultimately, I am the six-year-old who grew up a Chicago Bulls fan. They started winning championships when I was six. I'm the biggest fan in the world.
Right.
So now I get to use my understanding of psychology to create experiences for fans that I myself would have wanted. And it's really enjoyable.
So you mentioned that. I think what's interesting is the way that technology and our ability to know our consumers affects us now, in the end, should make our lives better and easier, but people are also afraid of it
mm-hmm.
because there is this fear of, like, Big Brother is watching you.
Yep.
So there's a really negative response or feeling about them using our information to get to us. But in the end, most of the time, it's to get to us in a way that will make us happier so we use the product or buy the tickets or do whatever. So when you're doing your job, how are you balancing the getting of information from people with turning it into something that's a reward?
Yeah, so that's a perfect question. And it's actually something that everybody in the industry is thinking about right now. When I was in grad school, I had this exact conversation with my best friend from undergrad who was the head of retail innovation for eBay. And I said, okay, we're in an era where data is now becoming both a benefit and a concern for consumers. How do you manage that in your day-to-day job? And he said something that I thought was really insightful. He said, in today's day and age, people know that you're using data to try to create recommendations that are specific to them, to sell them stuff, to market to them, etc. He said, the only time they get upset is when you misuse their data and they have a bad experience.
Right.
So there are famous case studies about Target, for example, where they inadvertently sort of outed a 16-year-old pregnant girl. Because they had an algorithm running in the background that said, we know what to recommend on the basis of other purchases, and it became a PR nightmare for them.
Right. I've seen people do that where they share a computer and wedding rings keep mm-hmm. coming up, and then the woman knows she's going to get proposed
right.
to, and it's ruined things.
Right. So same type of thing. Internally, what we say is sports is – we have the benefit of the fact that it's a passion activity. So if you can do things that actually does improve people's interaction with the team – that has real value versus other industries where they're just clearly trying to sell you stuff.
Right.
What we talk about internally all the time is if we're going to ask people to give us information about them, we have to be ready to deliver some value or benefit on the other end. So if we ask for their birthday, are we in a position to provide a personalized birthday message to them or a video from a player wishing them a happy birthday?
Mm-hmm.
We need to be in a position as an organization to use data to actually create a better experience so people are like, okay, I get why they asked me that.
Right. And I think it's not only that you didn't provide a positive, but that you feel like you were duped. So, for instance, there was a site called unrollme.com, and it was going to help you, like, if you got sick of getting 8,000 messages from every single, like, furniture company after you moved to a new house, you would go to unrollme.com, and you would be able to easily click all the places that you just wanted them to go immediately to the trash instead of seeing them. And it just came out maybe a month or two ago.
Yeah, and as a side note, you know, they have the do not call list. I'm sure I'm on the please call me list because I get calls every day from people who are
right.
telemarketers.
Right.
I have no idea how to get out of that.
Yeah. Yeah. There's this stupid, I was in this bowling league like years ago with friends and I've unsubscribed 20 times and I just get more from them and I'm like, this is clearly a fake unsubscribe button. But the unrollme.com people, you don't even think about how they make money. You're just like, this is a good service. I don't even care. I'm not even going to wonder how they make money. You find out later that there's also, they're being able to tell companies that you have X amount of Uber receipts in your email inbox. And this is where you used it and where you got it from and how much you spent. And so they can work with all these companies to tell them all this information about you and what else is in your inbox and where else you're shopping and what you're not unclicking on and what you are. And that's when you're like, wait, I didn't agree to that. Right? You're using my information in a way I didn't know and tell you you could. That's when you, it becomes a negative. Even if it doesn't affect you in a negative way, you feel duped.
Yep.
So you have to protect against that.
Yeah. And that's why I'm happy I don't work for companies like that. Right. I mean, sports is pretty straightforward, right? We're going to deliver you content, video, highlights, et cetera, that is specific to you. But other companies do make a living sort of selling your data or monitoring what you're doing. And I think the next frontier of legislation is actually going to be around privacy. In Europe, there are services that can actually remove sort of your entire internet footprint. That doesn't exist here. But I think in the next 10 years, that's going to be a hot button topic of what are companies legally allowed to do? And there's already rules in place for it to some extent.
Some of which are trying to be repealed.
Yeah.
It's very problematic.
I think you're going to see in the next 10 years people putting more thought behind protecting people's privacy so that their behaviors aren't monitored by companies who are looking to capitalize off of information about them.
So you talked about bending time, and I remember at the management summit you talked about the peak end theory. Can you mention how that applies to the sports experience?
Yeah, that's one of my favorite stories. So at the roundtable at Duke, we were discussing a number of different behavioral economics principles, and one of the guys who was present was Mike Norton from Harvard. He's done some research, but the actual original experiment was done by Daniel Kahneman, who looked at colonoscopies. And so the peak end effect is basically that people disproportionately remember the peak of an experience and the end of the experience, so much so that those two stand out disproportionately in people's minds relative to everything else that happened. So the experiment that Daniel Kahneman ran was with colonoscopies, and I won't go into too much detail about it, but basically in the control version, they did the normal 30-minute procedure. And then in the other version, they did the normal 30-minute procedure, but then they left the device in for 5 extra minutes that were unnecessary to the procedure. Well, relative to the rest of the experience, those final 5 minutes were significantly less disruptive.
Because they didn't do anything with it.
That's exactly right.
It just felt like nothing versus uncomfortable.
Yes. And so because of it, the way people remembered back on the experience was more favorable, even though it was an unnecessary 5 minutes, right? If we were perfectly rational beings, an unnecessary 5 minutes
would never... We would want less of a colonoscopy.
That's exactly right.
As little as possible.
That's exactly right, but it changed the experience. And actually, that's how Dan Ariely first got into behavioral economics. Dan suffered burns over 70% of his body when he was 18, and he was in the hospital. And the nurses, which were incredible and wanted to do what was in the patient's best interest, when they would change his bandages, they started with the least painful part of his bandaging and worked their way up, thinking that they were preparing for it. Mm. And Dan recalls back, I wish they would have started with the worst part, and then I knew that was over.
Yeah.
And so everything from there on out would be better.
Yeah, because that makes complete sense. You would not want to continue looking, knowing it's getting worse. You're steeling yourself for the worst thing the whole time versus being on your way down.
That's exactly right. Ooh. Anticipating how bad it can get will drive the mind crazy. And that's sort of the interesting origin story of Dan's relationship with behavioral economics, is he knew that the nurses wanted to do what was in his best interest. He knew they were really good people, and yet they had completely reversed what would have been in his best interest because of the psychological component.
Right.
And so that's what sort of behavioral economics seeks to understand, is that sort of everything we do in life is based on an appeal to someone's psychology, right? Every interaction, every date, every office relationship, everything we do from a marketing and sales standpoint, it's all based on psychology. Failing to understand the underlying principles of that can mean that in the case of like the sports league, for example, that thought pick-a-line formats were better, we might inadvertently be doing things to people that lead to negative experience and we're completely unaware of it.
Right.
And so one of the examples, sort of one of the foundational studies in behavioral economics is around the concept of choice paralysis. And basically, Barry Schwartz wrote a book called The Paradox of Choice about some other people's experiments. But the famous study is about jams in supermarkets. And so in one condition, they offered 6 jams to shoppers. In the other, they offered 24. And an economist would tell you that more options is always to the benefit of the chooser, or at least it's net neutral, right? If it's a bad option, it'll simply be discarded by the decision maker. In reality, though, there's a cost to evaluating options from a mental standpoint. And we spend a lot of time thinking about the costs that we're imposing on customers and fans from a hard cost standpoint, we don't spend nearly enough time thinking about the mental cost that goes into making decisions. And so in the example of jams in supermarkets, not only did people buy more jams when there were only six options, but they were overwhelmingly more satisfied.
And the choice they made.
That's exactly right. And the reason,
it's regret again.
It's regret again.
Yeah.
Yeah. They didn't have sort of that counterfactual of, oh, I could have got this other option. Instead, they were just happy with what they chose. And so in the example of sports arenas, in terms of merchandising, making decisions easier for people. So, like, for example, in our team store, we have 108 different versions of New Era hat.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like, think about someone during halftime who has 5 minutes to make that choice.
Yeah.
For a lot of people, that can be incredibly overwhelming. And I know how we got there, right? We said, if we offer more options to people, that will be to their
something
benefit.
For everyone.
That's exactly
yeah.
right. They'll be more happy. They'll be happier with what they ultimately decide. But in reality, that's not the way the mind works.
Right.
And so one of the things that we're going to start to be really conscious of is offering people sort of instructions for how to start. So whether it's creating a starting five of these are the five most popular hats, or these were hats designed by players. Amazon does a great job with it, or this is the recommended option, or people like you also buy.
Yeah.
We need instructions as to where to start our process, and I don't think companies are good enough yet at providing that.
Aziz Ansari wrote a great book with a dating and sex researcher,
mm-hmm.
and I forget the name. It's not Master of None. It's whatever. It's anyway.
Modern Romance.
That's yeah. it. Did you read it?
Yeah.
Okay. And he talks about the same thing applies to, for instance, online dating. That how was it that people used to find a spouse that they spent 60 years with in the building next to them on their block? And it was always that, right? That you went to church together, or you went to school together, or you're a family friend. That's how you met your spouse. And that's not to say that all those relationships were as satisfying and wonderful as maybe they could have been. But his research found that for many of them, they were incredibly happy and they lived incredibly happy lives. Now, you're not limited to the people in your surrounding areas. Mm-hmm. You can have anyone in the world. You can connect to anyone in the world online, via the internet, whatever. And because of that, there's the paralysis of choice. Instead of believing that someone is good enough, you believe there's probably someone out there better than that because your choice is endless. And so people get caught up where they're not finding a partner at all. Or they're going on one date, there's one thing wrong with them, and then they're like done with them because they have so many other choices that they presume that person to not be perfect and therefore not the right choice, not the soulmate, not the perfect one.
Mm-hmm.
It's such a fascinating read because if it applies to hats or jams, it very easily applies to the person that you want to spend your life with.
Yep. Yeah, I mean, it's choice is not always the greatest thing in terms of actually making a decision. We will tend to imagine what, as you said, what could be or what might be next. So think about someone sitting down at a slot machine. It's always, okay, it's going to be the next spin.
Right.
That's going to be the winner. And that's actually what leads to like people becoming addicted to things like slot machines.
Right.
Is sort of the variable nature of the reward is what incents them to continue playing, because you always believe that what is best or better is around the corner. And so in your example of dating online, you will envision, like, maybe there's a better choice out there. And so you will, instead of making a good choice, you will not make any choice.
Yeah. I wonder if there's any studies about people's happiness in terms of their decision-making strategies. Because I have friends who have a lot of trouble making decisions. There's too many choices. They just never make any choice, or it stresses them out, or they need to see. I have a great friend who saw 100 different apartments in person before she picked hers. My husband and I saw 5. She cannot buy bedroom furniture because there's too many options and she can't decide what she wants. So she just hasn't bought it for years trying to figure out exactly what she wants. We just say, this looks good, we'll take it. And that's not to say we're inherently happier or not, but I think there are probably people who are more satisfied with what they have because their brain chemistry, for whatever reason, allows them to just be okay with making a choice.
Yep.
And then there are others who will never feel satisfied because it always feels like they could have made a better choice or that they need to see everything else before they can choose.
Right. So, I mean, the entire principle of choice architecture underlies behavioral economics, which is that the order in which we are presented with information matters in terms of not only what we choose, but how satisfied we are with the outcome. So, for example, when you go around with a realtor and they show you 4 different places, what they're doing is they're leading you up to the 5th one because they know that's one that you'll probably choose. Imagine doing that in reverse and having them show you 4 places that you can't afford and finally getting around to the one that's right for you. You would be way less satisfied with
right.
that option. because your mind would be making comparisons to what you saw before that. And actually, there's a principle in behavioral economics called asymmetric dominance, which is that in a vacuum with two equivalent choices, it's hard for people to know which one they prefer without a reference point. Hmm. So let's say I offered you a free trip to Paris and a free trip to Rome. Right, both of them are incredibly attractive offers. It's hard to know which you'd prefer. But now let's say I said, you can have a free trip to Paris, all-inclusive. You can have a free trip to Rome, all-inclusive. Or you can have a free trip to Rome, but you have to pay for coffee. All of a sudden, the free trip to Rome that's all-inclusive looks way better by comparison. So introducing that comparison set actually guides people to make choices for that specific thing.
Wait, because you had to pay for coffee, it looked better?
Well, because you introduced an option that was less attractive, and so you were able to evaluate the new option in reference to the other option.
Got it.
So you said, oh, Rome all-inclusive.
Right.
That's really attractive because I could have been stuck with having to pay for stuff.
Right.
But I don't. And so all of a sudden, in that decision, you now have a reference point that allows you to see the value of going to Rome.
So let's get back to peak end. One of the things you talked about is the idea of a sport doesn't end when the last buzzer sounds. It ends when you leave the stadium, you get in your car, you get home, you go to sleep, and then you think about next Wednesday night, do I want to do that again? Because the entire process involved me spending this many hours and getting home and not sleeping as much, everything else. So how do you approach something like that so that the end, especially if they say lose, ends up being a positive?
Yeah, so I mean, that's what Mike raised at the roundtable, is basically like, what's the last thing of the game? And as you pointed out, it's not the final whistle. It's leaving the stadium, getting in your car, being tired the next day, et cetera. So Mike ran a study as a follow-up to Kahneman's study with the DoubleTree Hotel. And basically, they were giving away warm chocolate chip cookies when you checked in. He said, well, why don't you give away those chocolate chip cookies when people check out? And he flipped it, and all of a sudden, satisfaction went through the roof because it was the last thing they remembered. It was the end. In the context of sports, the question he raised to the group was, why do teams give bobbleheads out at the beginning of the experience? You're already at your emotional apex. You have to carry that thing around now for 2 hours. Wouldn't you be better off giving something to someone that they can leave with at the end of the experience? There are logistical and operational reasons why.
Maybe you'd have to give, because they usually give a limited number.
Yeah.
So maybe you give out a coupon
to
the first 10,000, and then on their way out, if they want to get one, they get one. But then there's other lines, and they were there wouldn't have been a line on your way out the same way there was on the way in.
Right.
So it's easier to monitor. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you could probably solve for that, and we're spending some time thinking about like logistically how you would do it, because you don't want it to backfire and create a bad experience.
Right.
Where all of a sudden, it's hard to get out of the stadium.
Yeah.
But the principle underlying psychology is that if you can do something nice for someone at the end of the experience, all of a sudden changes the way they remember it. So giving someone something to occupy their time as they're waiting in traffic to try to get out of the parking lot, or whether it's a broadcast that they can listen to while they're leaving, all of these things at the end of the experience. And Disney does this really well. So you go on your vacation with your family, you come home, you're tired, you're doing laundry, you have to get up to go to work the next day. And then 2 days later, you get a digital scrapbook of your experience.
Mm-hmm.
And so the last thing you remember about your trip is not traveling home. It's looking through that scrapbook with your family and remembering the experiences that you had. And so I think teams will become a lot better at capturing moments for fans and sharing with them so that, the last thing they remember is something incredibly positive.
I appreciate all the shout-outs for Disney, since ESPN is a Disney company. I did not pay you for this.
No, you didn't, but they make fun of me internally because I reference them all the time.
Yeah.
But it's a company that spent 75 years thinking about how to create great experiences. And what I think is interesting about them and Pixar, for example, they're companies that have a relationship with fans that becomes an identity level relationship, right? Like, I don't know if you grew up as like a Disney princess or watching movies.
Oh, no, not a princess, but I watched the movies, but
right.
No, I was an athlete, not a princess.
Yes, but I mean, the experiences that you create for people, as soon as you watch a movie, now you want to go on the ride. As soon as you go on the ride,
right.
You want to
Buy the merchandise, buy the doll, sing the song, buy the CD.
Right.
Yeah.
Everything that Disney does is meant to reinforce every other aspect of their business.
Right.
And I did grow up watching Disney movies. I love them, The Lion King, Aladdin.
Right.
It becomes a part of who you are. And sports fandom is really unique in society in that way. Along with religion and politics, it's probably one of the few things that becomes identity-level construction. So the fact that you are a fan of this team communicates something to the outside world about how you perceive yourself and what you value. And so the example is like, Duke blue is different than North Carolina blue, is different than Kentucky blue. on the surface, those are very minor nuances, but they mean an incredible deal to the people who are fans of those teams.
Right.
And wrapped up in those associations is a value statement and a communication of what you stand for through the medium of the team.
Well, yeah, you said it becomes like an identity, and we notice that when fans say we.
Right.
Right? And it's interesting. I've written stories about how there's a more natural separation between artists and the art they create and athletes and their athletic achievements, because you're watching it as it happens.
Mm-hmm.
And so we can look at someone like Woody Allen and be deeply troubled by accusations against him, but we can feel as though watching his movie isn't supporting him in the act. It's been made and it's out there. And especially if we don't pay for it because it's just on TV, we are not furthering him in a positive way, which is very different from an athlete who commits a crime and then we put on their jersey and watch them in real time and root for them. That affects the way we view our identity as because they become a part of us and because it is connected to the place that we live so often.
Yep.
So they represent more than just the team or themselves. They represent your city and your fan base and the things you stand for in a way that a musician or a movie person doesn't. You don't care if they represent MGM or this company is who produced this. That's not your identity. In sports, we have so much more trouble separating the person from the player than we do the artist and the art because of that. And that's a very positive thing for sports and for teams like you who are trying to draw into people who view the Bulls as their identity, right? But it's also negative because it causes people to literally murder over sports. How do you use your practices, or can you use your practices, to determine ways to dissuade people from using that identity to enforce or influence acts that are inhumane and insane?
Yeah, so you and I talked about that a little bit at the Global Sports Management Summit. There's some research about how to create, and I think they did this in some South African country over preservation of wildlife. But what they basically did, a researcher over the course of 15 years, created brand associations with being from that country that reinforced the idea that we do not do that.
It might even be Tanzania. When we were in Tanzania, they made the national, like the animal for that country, the giraffe, and they made it so revered that if you were to kill it, you were destroying the country.
That's exactly their
national pride. The same as like an American would feel pretty terrible about killing a bald eagle.
Right. So if you're a sports team and you're trying to curb acts of violence from your fan base, the single best way that you can do that is link the fact that fans of my team do not engage in this behavior to their underlying identity. I am a fan of this team. Fans do not do that.
Right.
So role modeling for them and sort of educating them on what a good fan does and does not do is the most powerful way to get someone to move away from activities that you don't want them to engage in, like fan violence.
And that one's hard, though, because it feels like it's harder to non-consciously do, right?
Yep.
If you go to, like, an Eagles game, and we know that there's this reputation for Philly fans, and then they tell you, Eagles fans root for their team and are supportive of opposing fans, and Eagles fans, you're listening to it like, all right, nice try.
Well, because it's disingenuous.
Right. And
it doesn't match.
But yeah, because you already know. Or Oakland, if Oakland tried to do that. So what would they do? It would have to be a non-conscious where they're appealing to people in a way that they didn't know that they were even being psychologically affected.
Well, I mean, that's a larger point, right, is that marketing by definition is an interruption. It can be a positive interruption or a negative interruption. And typically, we develop from a very early age an aversion to being marketed to. Right? Your parents say, eat your peas, you knock them on the floor. We don't like being influenced and have our choices made for us. So in the case of trying to evolve a culture like Oakland or Philadelphia, what you would have to do is probably have someone who has credibility in the community be the champion of that message.
Yeah.
So that it was credible coming from this person. So when you look at teams that have magnanimous owners, for example, that are really well respected in the community, when the message comes from that person, it's always better received than if the team does something that comes off like a cheap marketing exercise.
Right. It's interesting. I notice stuff like that, like when you fly JetBlue or certain places where they've made the safety instructions a really cool video that's kind of like quirky and sarcastic instead of feeling very rote. It makes you watch it out of you're kind of giggling at the silliness of it, and you realize that they're doing the exact same thing everywhere else did, but you appreciate them for not making you watch the same old, here's how a seatbelt works. And you're like, well, no.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
And
you appreciate it. And even though you know they're doing the same thing to you, you're okay with it because you like that they tried to. spin it.
That's exactly right. And that's sort of the purpose of cultivating a brand personality, which is something behavioral researchers study, is basically like, if you envision this brand as a person, how would you describe them? And underlying all of this, especially in sports, because of the emotional nature of the connection between fans and teams, is authenticity. And so to be able to communicate the story of your brand, the story of your players, in a way that resonates with people as authentic. We've done a lot of research recently with focus groups of millennials, and we said, you know, what type of content do you most gravitate to? And they said, it's not the packaged form content. Yeah. It's not the manufactured and curated videos that used to be really popular with people. It's what can you show me behind the scenes that I can't see anywhere else? Like, you have access to all this content, all the stories that go behind the scenes with players. Share that with me because I can see something that I can't see elsewhere.
I talk about this a lot in sports because the perfect example of that is Charles Barkley.
Mm-hmm.
He, even when he says something you don't agree with, even when he says something mildly offensive, because he's genuine and because you believe that he's transparent with his thoughts, whether good or bad, you like him. And then there's like a J.J. Watt who is perfect and doing exactly what's expected, and that's actually turned some people off because they don't think it's genuine. It's too good to be true. And I think especially because of social media and the way that we interact now, transparency and genuineness are paramount over everything else because people don't want to feel like they're being – the wool's being pulled over their eyes or that they're not getting the real person. And because we do have access in ways we never have before and we can see certain people in their real self, now we want everyone to be like that.
Yep.
And because we're so used to being marketed to.
Yeah. It's refreshing change of pace. And actually, so our social media team just received the Sports Business Journal Award for Best Social Media Team in
Awesome.
Sports. I can tell you, working with those folks, that the content that they produce perfectly matches their personalities. So, like, it's literally an embodiment of who they are as people. And I think that comes across in the end. They are just being themselves. They're having fun with creative ideas. And I think our fans respond because of that.
This is so awesome. I could keep talking about Olvix. I'm so fascinated by it. I'm going to start reading some of these books because I love applying these ideas to the larger questions of sport, since that's what I'm more interested in than box scores and stuff like that. But before you go, you have to do the one thing that everybody does.
I didn't expect a kind of Spanish Inquisition. Nobody expects the Spanish Inquisition.
That's right, the Spanish Inquisition. Nobody expects the Spanish Inquisition. Number one, what's the natural talent you wish you were gifted with?
Oh, man. To be an incredible writer.
That's not your forte?
It's something that I'm working on, but I just marvel at people who have that gift of being like, speaking for me is a very comfortable medium. It's just a communication tool, but as soon as you sit down in front of a computer to write something, it seems very formal and very like, what I put down on paper is going to be preserved forever. The people who have the ability to just write stream of consciousness and say exactly what they mean, I think that's an incredible gift.
Number two, what's your desert island album? You can only have one.
Journey.
All right. Number three, if you could switch lives with anyone for a day, who would it be?
Great question. It would be someone like, it wouldn't be an athlete. It would be someone like Malcolm Gladwell.
Because you'd want to have the knowledge that he's spent years acquiring?
Well, there's that, and then just the ability to have access to people who are interesting thought leaders.
Right.
Like, the more people you meet over time, the more different perspectives you hear, the more it changes your own thinking.
Right.
Someone like him who has the network that he has. It's interesting. There's a guy by the name of Ori Brathman who I'm going to be doing a panel with out in San Francisco. And Ori wrote a number of books, Sway, The Starfish and the Spider, The Chaos Imperative. But Ori's hypothesis is that in the future, CEOs will be hired not just on the basis of their skill level, but on the basis of the network that they have access to. Because networks increasingly will solve problems in the future. And so his idea for interviewing people in the future is sort of like phone a friend. You have an hour to solve whatever problem. If your network is so strong that you can get someone else on the phone who's an expert in that, that's fine with me. Call whoever you want and solve the problem whatever way you want to go about it.
You know what's funny about that is the first response I was going to have to that was sort of how Trump stole this presidency, but with no actual, like, he didn't have any actual people that he can use. He just said, I'm going to have the best people on this, and everyone trusted him, and as we found, that's not the case. But then it also reminded me of the Celebrity Apprentice, which is a Trump endeavor, because that's how they used to do it, too. It basically was like, it wasn't necessarily how great the celebrity was. It was also, who do they know? That will donate money or show up or, you know, what's their network? And Any non-Trump related examples, I think that's a very good way to do things. We've seen it also fail. Number four, what's the most scared you've ever been?
Most scared, I had acid reflux once, and I thought I was having a heart attack. Sometimes it actually
like heartburn. You mean?
Yeah, heartburn.
Okay, yeah, because acid reflux is just something you always have, but heartburn feels like you have something stuck and you're going to die.
Yeah,
yeah, that's the most scared you've ever been.
Well, yeah, I mean, like I literally lived a charmed life. Heart attack.
Charmed life, though.
Well, yeah.
Number five, what habit or quality do you think has contributed most to your success?
The ability to be a lifelong learner and intellectually curious.
A lifelong learner?
Yeah, learner.
I think curiosity is huge for anybody who's in a position of yours or journalistic, too. Like, you have to care to constantly be learning.
I'm repeating a quote that a friend of mine shared with me, but he said there are two types of people in life. There are knowers and there are learners. Be a learner. And at the time he said it, I didn't exactly know what he meant, and now I do.
Like, he was calling you a note at all. No.
Well, he might have been. But, yeah, no, I mean, there are people who are just content to be proud of what they know today and don't think about what they can learn tomorrow.
Yeah.
And I think that's what separates people like Gladwell and other thinkers is that they have this insatiable thirst for knowledge.
Yeah, totally agree. Number six, what's the thing about yourself you'd most like to improve?
I wish I was more of a morning person.
Mm.
Like, I go through periods of time where I get up and go to the gym at 6 a.m., but like every piece of research about really successful people says that they have a morning routine that they stick to, like it's religious.
I do not.
Like, I'm not like that at all. Like, I like
sitting in. I wake up at the last possible moment to get to the place that I need to be on time.
Yep. Yeah, I'm the same way. So I wish I was.
But there's other studies that say people who like are late night people get amazing things done at night. It's like whatever study you go to will tell you what you want to hear.
Well, that's absolutely true. But I mean, that's the creativity in you that's coming out. Like, whatever helps release that creativity is what you should do. And so it's just a different way of doing it. Like Albert Einstein famously, someone said, a messy desk is a sign of a messy mind. And he said, well, what's an empty desk a sign of?
Right. Yeah. I would like to be more of a morning person too, but it's getting later and later in life where I'm like, maybe I just accept it.
Yeah.
And finally, number seven, what three words would you most hope that people would use to describe you?
Generous, creative, and insightful.
Generous, creative, and insightful. Those are all very good. Thank you so much for making time for me.
Absolutely. Thanks, Sarah.
Oh, and another thing.
So this week's That's What She Read is a story that actually took me two sittings to get through. Not just because it was long, but because I was in a restaurant eating lunch by myself, crying all over my food, and actually having trouble even eating it because it was so emotionally powerful and heartbreaking and really hard to get through. But it's worth it. And it's an incredible story of love and selflessness, and it's worth your time. It's by Mitch Albom, and it's written for the Detroit Free Press called Chica's Story. You can find it on freep.com by searching Chica's Story. C-H-I-K-A is Chica. It's the story of a young Haitian girl that Mitch Albom and his wife sort of unintentionally and unexpectedly adopted, and the heartache of watching her suffer through a very rare disease. And that's all I'll tell you about it. It's a beautiful story of love and hope and struggle, and just reminds you the tough things that people are going through that maybe you're not even aware of behind the scenes. And, you know, there's a line where they're with the young daughter eating ice cream sundae at Serendipity in New York, and the treatments that she's going through for her disease have made her heavy and swollen and overweight. And he says there's a woman kind of watching, giving the eye, like she really needs that ice cream. And he gave her sort of a death stare back. And sometimes we just don't know what's going on with people. So let's be kinder to them. I highly recommend reading it. And thanks, as always, for lasting about an hour with me.
Well, that's what she said.